to Schools in Focus, an 1105 media podcast. I'm Yvonne Marquez, senior editor at Spaces for Learning and Campus Security and Life Safety. COVID-19 continues to be a health risk to in-person learning at schools and universities. One way schools and universities can mitigate the COVID-19 risk is to utilize their HVAC systems to circulate clean, fresh air. I spoke with Mike Wolf, Director of Regulatory Affairs, and Ron Windorsky, Director of the Bernard A. Greenheck Education Center from Greenheck, a HVAC equipment manufacturer, to talk about indoor air quality in classrooms. They explain how foundational technologies like increased air ventilation and filtration can help reduce the spread of COVID-19. They also explain how additive technologies like ultraviolet technology and bipolar ionization can help. We also discuss cost-effective ways to improve HVAC systems and the long-term benefits of indoor air quality. Let's hear from Mike Wolf and Ron Windorsky. Hello, and welcome to Schools in Focus. I have Mike Wolf, Director of Regulatory Affairs, and Ron Windorsky, Director of the Bernard A. Greenheck Education Center, today to talk about indoor air quality. Why don't you start off and tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do? We could start with Mike.
Well, my name is Mike Wolf, and I've been with Greenheck for 35 years, held a number of positions in the company in that time. Most recently, my activities have been focused around industry, trade association work, and regulatory work, largely related to efficiency type subjects. But obviously, with the advent of COVID, the COVID pandemic taking up a lot of our attention for the past year, I've also started to focus on indoor air quality much, much more. I'm located at our headquarters in central Wisconsin, and I've got four kids, one that just graduated from college and one that's in high school. So, you know, this what we're talking about today with regard to indoor air quality in schools is kind of near and dear to my heart and hits pretty close to home. I'm also a past school board member for our local district here, and my wife is on the school board now. So, again, we get a lot of attention and focus put on, you know, what's going on in schools and keeping our kids healthy. So it's a little bit about me.
All right. And my name is Ron Windorsky, and I'm the director of our customer training here at Greenheck. So I oversee our in-person and virtual product training and any customer education events. I've been with Greenheck for 20 years, and like Mike, I've had various roles in the organization, including product development engineer for our commercial fan business. I spent some time in our laboratory and fume exhaust business as engineering manager and product manager. And most recently, prior to this role, I was a regional sales manager. I'm located in central Wisconsin, which is our global headquarters for Greenheck. And just a little bit about Greenheck, we manufacture air movement control and conditioning equipment specifically for commercial, institutional, and industrial buildings.
Awesome. Thank you both for joining us today. So I wanted to talk to you about indoor air quality just because it is related to keeping our schools safe during the COVID-19 pandemic. So although we have a vaccine on the way, COVID-19 continues to be a health risk for in-person learning at schools and universities. Since COVID-19 is an infectious airborne disease, it's important to maintain indoor air quality at educational facilities. Can you explain how HVAC systems and equipment play a role in mitigating the risk of COVID-19 in classrooms?
Well, yes, certainly that's important. I think it's also important just to reiterate that, you know, even with the vaccine, you know, coming out, there's still a potential for individuals to get COVID and spread it. And much like the flu shot, you know, we're going to have portions of the population that just aren't going to get immunized. So there's going to be an ongoing risk here and requirement to do more than just the the vaccinations and HVAC systems is going to be one way to add to that mitigation process. But ultimately, when we look at the vaccine rollout, the other thing is school-age children and young adults are probably going to be some of the last demographics that are going to end up getting vaccinated. So again, you know, the importance of having clean air and good indoor air in our schools is going to be even maybe more important than it's been in the past. You know, current mitigation, as we know, we recommend, you know, masks and social distancing, increased sanitation, like wiping, you know, washing hands and so on and so forth. That's going to be with us for a while. But certainly, I think, as we'll talk about more today, adding to that toolbox of solutions to reduce COVID risks are going to be tied to air distribution and conditioning systems in buildings. The thing is, many schools have HVAC equipment in place today that can be adjusted to mitigate the risk of COVID-19. Some educationals, you know, some facilities may, you know, may need to retrofit their existing equipment, and others may need new equipment to be installed in their HVAC systems. But the goal here is to have properly installed and operating HVAC systems that brings in clean, fresh air from the outside and ultimately improves the quality of air that the kids are breathing.
I see. So what are key recommendations for schools and universities to improve indoor air quality? And can you give us any examples of how schools or universities are doing this now?
Sure. So there are what I'm going to call some foundational technologies for schools and universities to improve their indoor air quality. And, you know, these are increased ventilation, specifically with a focus on humidity control within that space, and also increased filtration. And there's also some newer, more advanced technologies, things like ultraviolet light or bipolarization, which are additive technologies to these existing systems. So I'm going to talk a little bit about increased ventilation, and I'm going to let Mike talk and expand a little more on filtration and additive technologies. You know, but for myself, I spent 8 years in our laboratory and fume exhaust business here at Greenheck. And during that time, I got to visit countless college and university research laboratories around the world. And what we had a saying in laboratory spaces, and it was the solution to pollution is dilution. And when we talk about these foundational technologies, really increasing ventilation rates is one of those main solutions. And by bringing in more fresh air into the space, the HVAC system can dilute the concentration of contaminants in the air, which isn't just about airborne viruses, but could also be VOCs or dust or bacteria in the air in the space. And with existing HVAC systems, so if we look at, you know, how do we apply this and how are schools or universities applying this, that could mean running those HVAC systems longer than normal occupancy mode. So we could start delivering fresh air to the space before our occupants arrive. And then we could continue to exhaust and purge that air out of that space after they leave. So this acts like a pre and post occupancy flush cycle of the air in that space. Now, another strategy for this ventilation is actually altering the scheduled runtime and going to 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation with these HVAC systems, really to prevent the buildup of contaminants and continually supply fresh air into that space, diluting contaminants. And then the last kind of strategy we've seen deployed is actually disabling demand control ventilation systems, which ultimately what that does is it maximizes the amount of outdoor air getting introduced into these spaces, regardless of the occupancy level within the space.
So I'll take the next one here, Yvonne. It's the kind of the next foundational thing. And the reason Ron and I refer to these as foundational technologies are they're things that are already in place in most buildings. So it's just a matter of hopefully, you know, possibly just tweaking what's already in place. So ventilation is certainly number one. Another, I think, very common technology, again, that's foundational is filtration. You know, most buildings already have some sort of filtration system installed to help take, you know, dust particles and so on and so forth out of the air. But what we're going to be looking at doing, or what, you know, facility managers and folks need to do with regard to COVID is look at increasing the level of filtration by using filters that have a MERV 13 or higher. Filters are rated using something called a minimum efficiency reporting value, or MERV, and it goes from 1 to 20. And again, if we go with something 13 or higher, you know, this level of efficiency on the filter is going to, it's going to be effective at capturing probably about 85% or more, or at least 85% of the airborne respiratory droplets. So, you know, the things that we, you know, normally breathe in and out, you know, the size of those particles that we're exhaling, a MERV 13 is going to be effective at capturing at least 85% of those particles. The key here is, you know, we need to think about where we're applying the filters, because the filters are only going to be effective if the air passes over the filter. So if we've got dead spots in a room, or if we just don't have good circulation in the space and that air doesn't get to the filter, you know, the filter's not going to be effective at filtering out those particles. The other thing, you know, a few other things to consider when it comes to filtration is that, you know, if we put higher efficiency filters into your system and they start collecting COVID-19 pathogens, you know, the folks that we have doing the maintenance on our filters, you know, usually they just go in there with probably bare hands and no mask, and they just change out the filters and put new filters in. I think we need to be very cognizant of increasing the safety of our maintenance staff that go in and change these filters, you know, gloves, mask at a minimum, and maybe a little more. The other thing that we need to be, you know, cognitive of is when we go to these higher efficiency filters, you know, they are going to take, it's going to reduce the airflow. And I think Ron is going to touch on that. But, you know, power is also going to be something that we need to watch out for, make sure that we, you know, increase the speed of the fans to maintain the airflow in the space. And then the last thing I want to touch on with regard to filters is there's been a lot of movement, I would say, in the past several years towards something called dedicated outdoor air systems, where we're bringing fresh air into the space, you know, directly into the classroom, for example, and we're not recirculating the air. So in those cases, filters, you know, aren't going to be as effective because we're not recirculating the air that's in the space. We're going to have to make sure that we're getting, you know, adequate outside air into the space with the system. And really, you know, then we're just relying on the ventilation technology that Ron described earlier.
I see. And how is that done? How is outdoor air brought into indoor spaces?
So in most cases there, that's where we get into these Mike mentioned these dedicated outdoor air systems. So, you know, you may have a unit, a piece of equipment on your roof, and that unit is going to, you know, it's going to do some mechanical heating, it's going to do some mechanical cooling, but that's really where we're bringing the fresh air into the space, and in most cases, we're going to try to do some tempering of that air before it gets into the occupied space. So whether that's heating, whether it's cooling, whether it's some dehumidification, those dedicated outdoor air systems is how that fresh air gets into the space many times.
I see. Those are great recommendations. And I was wondering, as we're in the middle of winter, I'm wondering, how does weather and climate impact those recommendations? And what should facility managers be aware of?
So, you know, when we talked about increased ventilation, we need to be careful in regards to what our outdoor air conditions are, and being able to properly condition in terms of both humidity and temperature. So geographically, your listeners all have different climates that they're living in and that they have to deal with. So when you say winter to me, you know, I'm in central Wisconsin. So winter means below zero temperatures, low humidity levels, typically some snow going on outside. But, you know, to a to a listener in, say, a more southern climate zone, winter may mean a low temperature is 45 degrees and they have a lot of humidity. So the thing is having, you know, the equipment that we're looking at here be able to handle the increased ventilation and still properly heat, cool, and humidify the space. So, you know, I talk about humidity, and there's a lot of building research that shows that relative humidity levels in spaces between 40 and 60%, it creates conditions that microorganisms have a really hard time surviving in. So that's kind of that that range that we're trying to hit in our built-up space for our occupants is that 40 to 60%. And at the same time, these mid-range humidity levels, they're actually kind of a sweet spot for our respiratory system in terms of fighting respiratory infection. So as we look at each one of these solutions, you know, in different ways to increase ventilation, we need to be very cognizant, you know, making sure that our HVAC systems can handle the demand, whether it's for increased mechanical heating, or increased mechanical cooling, or humidity control. So, you know, I'll use an example here of, say, a school in a southern climate, and say we have a user and they're going to want to increase their ventilation rate, get more clean, fresh air into that building. And they're going to do that by simply, say, speeding up their supply fan on their dedicated outdoor air system. What they need to be careful with is to make sure that system is really properly sized so that there's enough mechanical cooling to handle the increased airflow, and that our space conditioners can handle the increased humidity levels potentially. Whereas back here in Wisconsin, if I decide I'm going to speed up my supply fans on my dedicated outdoor air system, I have to make sure I have enough mechanical heating to handle the increased outdoor air volume during the winter. So in either one of these scenarios, if I don't have the mechanical heating or cooling that I need, or the way to handle the humidity, there are different technologies we can look at. We can actually look at the addition of something called an energy recovery device into that system. And those pieces of equipment, sometimes they're called energy cores, sometimes they're called total energy recovery wheels. They're commonly used in new construction today because they're code driven, but in existing facilities, we can actually look at them as a retrofit option, which can help reduce energy costs and new equipment costs and still get good occupancy comfort in that space.
Awesome. Thank you for clarifying that and giving us those examples. So with tight budgets, schools and universities might not be able to overhaul or improve HVAC systems immediately. What are some cost-effective ways facilities can improve indoor air quality now?
Well, I think we've kind of touched on some of these already, but like you said, Yvonne, you know, nothing's free, right? Everything has a cost. So I guess just to kind of summarize what we've talked about so far with regard to these foundational technologies, obviously, you know, increases in ventilation, increased filtration efficiency levels, you know, are all going to have some upfront costs associated with them. But they're also going to have some potentially increased operating costs associated with them. For example, you know, ventilation, increasing ventilation means we're going to have more, you know, more energy consumption related to supply fans. You know, if we're running the fans longer to do these air flushes that Ron referred to, you know, that's going to take more energy. It's going to take more energy to heat and cool that air. And, you know, but the good thing is, from a cost perspective standpoint, because many of those technologies are already in place, we can use the equipment that's already in place to implement some of those mitigation strategies. And then the other thing, like Ron mentioned, when we're talking about heating and cooling, especially, you know, in the winter here in Wisconsin, or, you know, in hot, humid climates in the summer, using some sort of an energy recovery device to recapture some of the air that you're exhausting is also a very, very good way to help reduce some of the operational costs. You know, when it comes to filtration, again, some added costs there. You know, higher efficiency filters are going to be a bit more expensive than the lower efficiency filters. The other thing we kind of alluded to earlier is when you go to higher efficiency filters, you're going to increase your pressure drop in your system, which is going to increase the resistance to airflow. And in order to overcome that resistance to airflow, you know, many times we're going to have to speed up the fans. And when you speed up the fans, again, you're going to use more power. But again, the trade-off there is that, that, you know, hopefully you can use the equipment that you have and hopefully mitigate or minimize the amount of upfront costs that's going to be associated with putting this sort of a strategy in place. The other thing here, I guess, you know, that's important to remember too, is that, you know, I think every building, you know, even within a given school district, you know, a lot of buildings have different technologies. I know, for example, the school in our, you know, that in our school district where I was on the board for a number of years, we had five different HVAC systems in the building. And bear in mind, this is a pretty darn small school district. In fact, it's a, I don't want to say a one room, but we have K through 12 all under one roof, but we probably had about 7 or 8 additions since that school was originally built back in the 50s. So, you know, it's not a one size fits all fix here. You know, there's going to be different sizes of facilities. There's going to be different HVAC systems, you know, in different buildings, maybe even within the same building. And in order to, you know, come up with the best solution, there's not going to be one silver bullet, most cost-effective solution that typically can be used. You know, and the listeners are going to have to understand all these different options and explore what's going to be the best solution for their particular application. The good news here that I think some people may have heard already, you know, I just heard about this last week or over the holidays here. With this new COVID-19 stimulus package that went through Congress, I believe there's something in the neighborhood of $82 billion being earmarked for education, including K through 12 and, you know, higher education institutes to upgrade their HVAC systems. So, you know, I don't know exactly how that money is going to be made available to districts, but I would certainly look into how you can access those funds to implement some of the mitigation strategies that we've talked about here today.
I see. I guess a follow-up question to that would be just like, is there a way to start research on those ways that facilities can improve, or what should facility managers do, I guess, to get that started?
Well, I tell you what, that's another great question, Yvonne, and I kind of had that in my wrap-up here, but we'll touch on it here as well. You know, I think the important thing to recognize, and I think everybody does, is the guidelines are changing. They're very fluid, you know, and the guidelines are changing rapidly as we continue to learn more about the COVID virus and also what works and what doesn't work. So my recommendation is, you know, go find an expert on the subject. Oftentimes, you know, that's going to be a mechanical engineering firm or an architectural firm that maybe has someone who specializes in pathogen type applications. As Ron mentioned, you know, we have a line of products that are designed for laboratory fume exhaust. And, you know, Ron certainly, because of his experience in that level, has more expertise in a lot of this stuff than I do, because he's dealt with pathogens in the past. So, you know, finding the right person who has some experience with this type of work and is very connected with what ASHRAE and the CDC and the World Health Organization are recommending, I think is the first place to start.
Great. So what are some long-term goals educational facilities should consider in order to improve indoor air quality beyond COVID-19?
So, you know, long-term, as education facilities look to improve overall indoor air quality, I think it's important to remember that this just isn't about preventing, say, the spread of COVID-19, which is the topic today. You know, these measures we're talking about, like increased ventilation rates, they can help mitigate the spread of more common respiratory illnesses like the cold and flu, you know, things we deal with every single year within school districts and within commercial buildings. There's a lot of research also that shows that children's performance in school, you know, is directly affected by their indoor environmental conditions, and that includes indoor air quality. You know, I'm a parent of three school age children, and I think about, as a parent, you know, all the things I do on a daily basis to try to protect my kids and keep them safe and keep them healthy. And as more and more schools return to in-person learning, I think it really gives parents a peace of mind knowing that, you know, indoor air quality improvements are part of that arsenal that we're using to combat, you know, not only the spread of COVID-19, but, you know, also other respiratory illnesses. And we want to send our kids into a healthy environment, you know, and it's a plus that there's also other long-term health advantages, and we can improve, you know, overall our children's learning performance by having good indoor air quality in these spaces.
I think another long-term consideration, just to kind of piggyback on what Ron's talking about here with IAQ, is how this plays into sustainability and energy efficiency. As I stated in my, you know, my introduction, a lot of my focus over the past few years at GreenHack here has been specific to reducing energy consumption in buildings and improving product efficiency. And, you know, sometimes that comes with a cost, and that cost is maybe reducing ventilation in a space. And certainly in the case of schools, you know, I think we all know that's not what we want to do. We want to make sure that we have, you know, our kids breathing, you know, good air. And not only our kids, but I think it's going to be in all buildings now. There's going to be a renewed focus on indoor air quality to assure that the air we're breathing is, you know, is healthy. But we need, you know, we need to balance that with the work we've been doing on energy conservation and efficiency and so on and so forth. So I think there's going to be a trade-off. I think the key here is going to be, you know, everybody's going to need to be patient. People want a silver bullet. They want a quick fix. And, you know, just to put the energy element in perspective, you know, this country started really getting serious about energy efficiency back in the mid-70s when we had the OPEC oil embargo, for those of you who are, you know, listeners who might remember back that far. And we've come a long way in the past, you know, what is it, almost three decades now? But it's taken a long time to get here. I think if there's a silver lining in this COVID pandemic cloud, it's the fact that we're going to put the focus on indoor air quality in a way that we should have been doing for a long, long time now. But we've been able to kind of ignore it because there wasn't anything serious going on. But now that we've got a very serious situation, you know, there are some technologies out there, and it's not going to take that much effort, I don't think, to implement these strategies. We just need to be cognizant of it. We need to plan accordingly when we're budgeting, you know, for new equipment and so on and so forth. But we also need to account for staff training and maintenance and so on and so forth. But it's very, very doable. It's just that, you know, up until now, we haven't focused on it maybe as much as we should have or could have. So I'm excited about what the future holds in terms of improving, you know, buildings and the air we're breathing in these buildings.
Yeah, those are some really good points. And I know you all touched about this briefly, but can you talk about how ultraviolet light technology and bipolar ionization can be used to mitigate viral risk? And are they commonly used?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah, we did touch on those, but, you know, up until this point, Ron and I, like you said, we kind of described what we call foundational technologies. The ultraviolet and bipolar ionization, I wouldn't say they're new technologies, but they're relatively new to these applications, and they're being applied with a very specific purpose in mind as it relates to, you know, mitigating the risk of COVID. So let's start with ultraviolet or UV technology. Okay, ultraviolet technology, as it's referred to, UV. This technology basically electronically cleans the air by using shortwave ultraviolet energy to destroy airborne and surface-bound microbes. The technology has been widely applied in healthcare facilities, honestly, since the 40s. So again, it's not new, but again, like I said, it is new to the extent we're applying it much more broadly than maybe we have in the past. The trick with UV light, though, is, there's two factors at play. One is the intensity of the light or the energy, and two is the time the microbes are exposed to the energy. So increasing either one of these increases the effectiveness of UV light. And there's two ways to apply the technology. One is referred to as upper room UV, where you have UV light shining upwards and you circulate air in the room to pass the microbes through the light source. And again, if assuming the microbes are exposed long enough with a strong enough light power source, it'll render the microbes ineffective or safe. And the other nice thing about that is UV can be damaging to skin or to people. So pointing it upward reduces the risk and exposure to humans by using this upper room UV technology that it's called. The second application is in the airstream. So you don't have the UV in the light in the room. You basically have it in your ductwork or in your ventilation system. And, it disinfects the air that passes through the ventilation system. But again, the challenge here is, if the air is traveling too fast or the microbes are moving too fast through the light, it may not kill them. So, those are the ways that UV technology can be used to destroy or purify the microbes or purify the air. The second one is referred to as BPI or bipolar ionization. And bipolar ionization helps mitigate the risk in two ways. What it does is it creates ions, both positive and negatively charged ions, and we force these ions through the HVAC system or we generate them into the room with some sort of a portable ionization device. And what these ions are capable of doing is they attack and they deactivate certain bacteria and pathogens, as well as other airborne particles and VOCs. So the other nice thing or the thing that BPI has been used for in the past is to reduce the odors in spaces. And also I think it's been used in swimming pool applications. For example, if you go into a motel and you smell that pool odor, oftentimes BPI or bipolar ionization has been used to get those types of things out of the air as well. The second way that the BPI helps mitigate the risk as well is these positive and negative charge ions help collect the particles and make larger particles so that when they pass through your filter, if you've got a filter that maybe isn't as efficient as the higher MERV filters that we talked about, because the particles are now larger, those filters will become more effective at filtering out the COVID virus as well. So that's a little bit about the what I would call additive technologies, Yvonne, ultraviolet technology and BPI. Again, they're not new, but in terms of being applied in ventilation systems to the extent they're being applied today is relatively new.
Okay, I see. There's been a lot more questions about those technologies, so I wanted to make sure we could talk about those. Yeah, so those were all my questions. Was there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about or any final thoughts?
I did have just some final thoughts on this. And, one thing as I was thinking about, all of these discussion points is over the last year, there's been such a big focus on masks and social distancing and proper hygiene and sanitation when it comes to preventing COVID-19 and the spread of that. And in order for those items to work correctly, we're really dependent on people changing their behavior and then following guidelines within our building spaces. you know, what Mike and I talked about today, it kind of takes the people out of that equation. You know, if we're increasing fresh outdoor air, if we're utilizing better filtration, if we're using any of these electronic purification devices, we're not asking people to change their behavior. You know, we're modifying how the building works, and that to me is really impactful for everyone in that building space. But ultimately, I think, you know, it takes some planning. It takes a little bit of work. It may take some investment. And like Mike mentioned before, you know, it may take bringing a professional in, an engineer, a mechanical engineer into the space, you know, to look at your existing system and give you some recommendations on things that you can do.
I guess, Yvonne, what I'd like to do is, you know, we covered a lot of material. As I shared earlier, this is my first podcast, so I feel like I've checked off a new, new life experience for myself today. But I think just summarizing what we've covered so far, we talked about foundational technologies, and the three foundational technologies that are already in place in a lot of buildings are ventilation. You know, we're supplying and we have ventilation air in buildings. So it's relatively easy, hopefully, to modify a system that's already in place in terms of the amount of air that's being used for ventilation in the space, and maybe even to bring in a little more fresh air is not all that difficult, and can be done with existing equipment. The second one, air humidification. Honestly, I was on a webinar right before we did this podcast, and we had one of the members of the ASHRAE COVID task force on there who is a medical doctor, and they were going through all the studies that show that if we can maintain relative humidity in a space of 40 to 60%, it's probably the single most effective way to reduce and mitigate the risk of COVID. So that's, again, another foundational technology that isn't new. We just need to be more diligent on measuring what our relative humidities are in spaces and making sure that we hold the relative humidity in ranges that are going to help mitigate the risk. And then lastly, air filtration. You know, again, we talked about that, and going to higher efficiency filters, again, is kind of a no-brainer, but it does come with some trade-offs in terms of, you know, the power required and the amount of airflow that might go through your system. And then finally, the last two, the additive technologies for air purification, you know, UV and BPI, or bipolar ionization. I think you mentioned they're certainly getting a lot of buzz these days, a lot of headlines. The thing that I've struggled with there is finding clinical studies that show that these technologies are effective in real life applications. There's a lot of lab studies that show they're effective, and certainly, again, if the microbes get exposed to the UV or exposed to the ions, there's no doubt that it works. But the challenge in real life applications is, can you get those COVID microbes exposed to the UV long enough or to a strong enough UV light source to kill them? And with BPI, can you, you know, are you going to get the are the ions going to last long enough? One thing I didn't mention with bipolar ionization is that the ions only have a limited life, and it's a life of minutes. So if you have a bipolar, an ionization generator that's generating ions into a space, you know, they need to come in contact with the microbes fast enough so that that they do their job. So again, a lot of material here. I guess if I were to wrap it up and just offer some final common sense, I guess, thoughts on the subject, you know, as Ron mentioned, and I think I mentioned, guidelines and recommendations continue to evolve. You know, find an expert on the subject who can, you know, give you the latest and greatest guidance in terms of what technologies are out there and which ones are going to be best and most cost effective for your application. With regard to anything anybody says, you know, or tells you, again, like we talked about, there's a lot of things in going on or claims being made. I call them flavors of the day. Ask that whatever, you know, you're hearing it, you know, what clinical study is there out there to support and verify what claims are being made. With regard to the system and also the equipment, And specifically with the equipment, you know, because we are an equipment manufacturer, you know, one of the things that, we do, and we certainly would, you know, expect others to do it as well, is, you know, any performance claims that we're making, you know, I think they should be supported by some sort of an independent third party verification test of some sort, because otherwise, you know, again, people can say anything, but whether it really, you know, whether the product really performs as the manufacturer claims it will, you know, I think it's just good practice, common sense, to have it verified by a third party. So again, sorry, that's a pretty long wrap up there, but I wanted to get that in there, Yvonne. Okay.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much, Mike and Ron, for your time. We learned a lot today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Yvonne Marquez, and this was Schools in Focus, an 1105 media podcast. Visit us online at spacesforlearning.com and at campuslifesecurity.com. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. See you next time.